Thank you, George, for hosting us, bringing us into the space. And hello, everyone. So good to see you from all over the world. I was watching as you were coming in your places. So if you haven't yet put a welcome notice, feel free to type that in on the side of your screen if you like, so we can see where you're coming in from and connect more to you. So I'm so glad to be with you this weekend, this afternoon or morning or evening, depending on where you are. Here in the United States, it's Thanksgiving weekend. So this is the gratitude weekend on the calendar in the US. And I've been thinking a lot about everything that I'm grateful for this weekend. And way up there on the list are the loving presences in my life, and also the practice of meditation. What I'm going to be reflecting on with all of you today is the foundation of meditation practice, that which we are all so grateful for. And that foundation is the body. So I'm going to be reflecting a little together with you in this session on why body is such a gift, both for our life and also for practice. And more deeply, why the body is the portal or the doorway, not only into a deep practice of mindfulness, but also to freedom itself. That is to say, if there is something that we might call awakening, as the Buddha called it, bodhi, or enlightenment, the body is our key. The body is our teacher and our guide to that awakening. Well, I'm going to explore that a little with all of you today. And we're going to begin, as we do in Sangha Live, with practice. In some ways, the deepest teacher is the practice, and all the teachings of the Dharma, everything else that we learn is like indicators, signposts. And ultimately, those signposts are pointing us to what we ourselves need to learn and discover. So the practice that I'm going to begin with all of you today is my own heart practice and has been for many years. I'm going to introduce it in the simplest way. There are different ways I can introduce it. I can introduce it with a little bit more elaboration in the beginning or elaboration in the end. We could do refuge and bodhicitta and dedication. I'm just going to do those in the lightest way and spend most of my time on the practice itself. And what this practice is that I'm introducing here is a practice that I'm calling the three layers of embodiment. And in my book, The Wakeful Body, which just came out, I talk about this practice as a practice of ground. But here with you today, I want to introduce it in a slightly different way. It's another door into the same practice, connecting to three layers of embodiment that coexist and are interpenetrating. And in the meditation practice, I'll guide you through connecting to the first layer, the second layer, and the third layer. The first layer is the earth body. And the earth body is my poetic words for the physical body. This body that is flesh and blood, material, solid, grounded, connected to the earth by gravity. That layer of our experience that is material, solid, animal. And then I'll guide us from that to the second layer of embodiment, which is the energy body. That is the sense that our body is pervaded by vibrant, alive energy. And sometimes I use the words all over aliveness for that body. That is, our body isn't just flesh and blood. It isn't just this gravitational solid thing. It's also pervaded by a vibrant, alive, palpable sense of energy. And then from there, we'll move to the third layer of embodiment, which is the awareness body. And the awareness body is the fact that not only are we physical, not only are we vibrant energy, but we're also knowers. And we are aware, and that awareness is aware of itself. So those three layers we're going to go through now in practice. So I invite you to settle into your place of practice and maybe to turn your eyes, your gaze away from the screen. If you're used to meditating with your eyes closed, you can do that. I meditate with my eyes open. And if you're new to that, you might try it. It's a really interesting way to meditate. And in the Tibetan tradition, we do it that way, with our gaze soft. You can allow the eyes to be downcast, if that helps you settle. Or if your eyes are open and you're used to it, you might raise them to take in the space and the light. We'll begin just by momentarily connecting to the sense of refuge as a field of support. Refuge is knowing that you are held in love and care. Just beginning with that sense of connectedness, recognition, refuge in your field of care. Well, now together, take three cleansing breaths. These breaths help us ground, relax, and cleanse this subtle body. And the cleansing breath is just a deep inhale all the way down into your belly, filling the belly, the lungs. And on an exhale, slow exhale, sending out any cobwebs in the mind or body that need to be released. Breathing out every last drop of air. And again, on your own, two more cleansing breaths. And coming back to the gentle breath. Breath. Breathing. You. And now allow your attention to float down from the thinking mind into the feeling body. Floating all the way down to the base of your body, where it meets a cushion or chair, to the place where your feet meet the ground, letting yourself rest there. Noticing how this earth body is naturally stable. Solid. And grounded. And just let that body's natural groundedness stabilize your flighty mind. Solid. Stable. Grounded. Feeling how just as this earth body is anchored to the ground, the mind too is anchored by the earth body. Solid. Stable. Ground. You'll notice that sitting in this way doesn't stop your thoughts. And you can see the thoughts as having their own gravity. So now and then, when you see a thought, imagine it has gravity. It descends to the base of the body and dissolves. Thoughts dissolving into earth body. Now allow your attention to move up into the torso. Through the hips and lower belly, and from there, spreading out into a diffuse attention that saturates the whole field of the body, as if your body were a vase of warm water and your mind were a handful of salt thrown into that vase, dissolving all over the body. And as you do that, noticing this all over vibratory aliveness permeating the body from your head to your toes, the energy body. Sentient, feeling, with eyes open, ears open. Breath open. Heart open. Mind open like a blooming lotus. Resting in the energy body, vibrant, luminous, feeling when you'll notice this energy body has the quality of flow. Like an ocean, there are waves of feeling, sensation, breath, but in its depths, the stillness. A vastness, you'll notice that resting there, thoughts continue to come and go. These are like the ripples of the energy body. Natural thoughts. Like waves, they rise out of the field of your energy and dissolve back into that field. If you leave them alone, natural thoughts. Now, turning your attention inwards. Notice who is aware. Who is meditating on this energy body? Finding the gaze of the pure witness. Yes, pure knower. Formless. Centerless. Embodied, but boundless. Resting in the awareness body. We can come back to our screen. So nice meditating with you this morning. So this practice is a really simple way of connecting with the physical plane, if you will, the groundedness of our physical body, the field, our body as a field of energy, the subtle body or the energy body, and this third layer of embodiment being awareness. And there's something about connecting, starting with the ground, starting with our connection to the earth, and moving up from there to a more expansive and sky-like state of attention or awareness that can help us really connect to the essence of the Buddha's meaning of wakefulness. So in the talk I'm about to give right now, the Dharma talk, I want to explore a little bit more this notion of how the body supports our practice of meditation and why the body is the foundation for our practice, not just for our practice, but even for awakening itself. And I want to turn towards four qualities of the body that make it our teacher, that make it our portal, if you will, to a deep and sustainable practice of mindfulness. And if we want to go further beyond mindfulness to greater wakefulness, to address the roots of our suffering, the body has that capability also. So just one moment. I'm going to bring up a few notes and have them in front of me while I'm talking to you. So first of all, I want to point out that we don't usually think of the body as a source of wisdom. We don't think of the body as this entity, this flesh and blood entity that can actually teach. And I think if we're really going to start from the very beginning, if we're going to train in a practice of embodied awakening or somatic mindfulness, then we have to first examine some of our presumptions about what the body is and does. And I think that for each of us, that's its own journey. And so we might want to look back on our body history. Like, how have I perceived my body over my lifetime? How do I perceive it now? What kind of concepts do I hold about the body? And as we start to explore that history, we might notice that we come to the practice of meditation with some assumptions and beliefs about the body. And I call that a conceptual body, because really the presumptions and the beliefs are not the body itself. So in the very beginning, we can start to discern those two things. And so some of our beliefs about the body: my body is limited, my body is mortal, my body is ill, my body is suffering from chronic illness, my body is beautiful or ugly, my body is fat or thin, right? We can have all of these notions about the body that have nothing to do with the experience of the body in the present moment. And what I'd like to turn us towards here, before my teaching will make sense, is another body other than the conceptual body, a body that is not our ideas. And that is the experiential body. Your body in this present moment, as you're sitting now and listening to me on the computer, just take a moment and notice this body in this present moment is experiencing all kinds of things, some of which may be backgrounded. But just right now, let's take it into the foreground a little bit. I'm breathing. I'm experiencing an inhale. I'm experiencing an exhale. Oh, I'm experiencing this sense of weight coming down through my body all the way into the feet. I can feel the ground beneath my feet. I can feel the contours of the floor beneath me. Oh, I can feel the feeling of the air on the back of my hand. So there's this field of experience. I'm describing a few of the corners of that field, but all of these things are happening at the same time. We are in this vibrant field of feeling and sensory experience. That is what I call the experiential body. We are in this experiential body. Now that you're there, this is what I'm talking about when I say the body can be your teacher. And you might notice when I say that with those words, the body can be your teacher, you can still feel the concepts rushing in. No, my body can't be my teacher. My body is chronically ill. No, these protests from the thinking mind, right? This is the conceptual body that pushes at the edges of the experiential body and says, you are limited. But just for a moment, you know, you can ask that voice of the conceptual body to relax and to step back and then you can begin to listen. And when you're listening, what you're listening for is the experiential body. And as you begin to listen to the experiential body, you discover that your body knows things. Your body has a kind of wisdom that is unspoken. And so when it's unspoken, right, we can't listen to the body chatter at us, but we can listen to the body in the sense of turning attention towards. And in fact, that's exactly what we do in meditation. We turn attention towards. That is why meditation is actually an act of deep listening. We are developing this kind of receptivity to what is happening in the present moment. And if we're working in a training of somatic mindfulness or bodily awakening, so many different words could be used for embodied awakening, for what I'm pointing at here. In that case, what we're listening deeply to is the present moment experiential body to see what does my body know. And if we start listening in this way, if we start listening to the body, we actually discover that the body can teach your mind. Your body can teach your mind. The mind we think of as the master. The mind we think of as the manager. The mind is our friend in some ways. But our mind is very... does a lot of controlling. And so in some ways, for the body to teach the mind, we have to surrender a little bit to the possibility that the mind doesn't have all the answers. The mind has some answers for us, for sure. The conceptual mind has so many ways that is helpful and useful, but the body can teach the mind. And we have to first ask the mind to surrender some of its control. So, what does the body teach the mind? And in this meditation practice that we just did, we started to get a sense of that a little bit. Maybe you started to get a sense of that. So the very first thing is. The mind is pretty flighty. Now, you can disagree with me, and I'll be interested in the Q&A if you want to bring this in. I disagree with you about this. I don't know about you. My mind can be very flighty and distracted. And I would bet that many people struggle with that. Maybe most of us struggle with that. That distraction, that tendency to be so flighty, can be ungrounding at times. We're running into the future, looking for something, or we're running into the past, worrying about or ruminating on something that happened, and we're not very, very present. So the mind has this quality of being very flighty. The body, however, when we begin to listen to the body, is grounded. And that is a universal truth. None of us are just floating off. Well, maybe if we go up into a spaceship, we would be floating off into space. But as long as we're on Earth, our body is attracted to that Earth. Our body is, by force of gravity, grounded. And when we begin to turn our attention to that truth, that our body is grounded, and we turn the mind towards the body, in that, and it's grounded, that feeling of groundedness, where our body is contacting the earth, where the tug of gravity is happening in the present moment, that helps to ground the mind. It's like we're taking a clue from gravity. Hey, body grounded by earth, and body can therefore ground mind, and mind can come down to earth. We can come down to earth through that medium of the body. So one of my favorite practices for just getting more stable, moving towards a state of peace, towards a state of less agitation, less anxiety, is so simple. It seems too easy to be true, is just to drop from that swirling, whatever we're caught up in the present moment, that swirling mess of thoughts, and just drop down to the base of the body and take a deep breath. Come all the way down to the base of the body. In that moment, the flighty mind takes a clue and we ground. So you're grounded. That's the first thing that the body teaches the mind. Second lesson from the body to the mind is, and you may have gotten a sense of this in the meditation practice as well, second message that the body sends to the mind as soon as we come down, really into any sensation. It could be the breath, it could be the feeling of the air on our skin, it could be that sense of groundedness at the base of the body. It could be a smell. It could be a sound. In the moment that we connect to the sensory field, to the body's field of feeling, we become present. We go from running into the future, anticipating what's going to happen next, ruminating on the past, to the present moment, because sensation is happening in this present moment. So the body is speaking to the mind, saying, you are present, without words. And the key to picking up that message, to picking up the teaching, is just coming into the sensory field, connecting to your body's aliveness and whatever's happening in the present moment, in this field of aliveness. You are present. And in the meditation that we just did, that sense of presence is facilitated by connecting to that second layer of embodiment, the energy body, which is the whole field of the senses and the field of aliveness that is interoception and proprioception, as not as one feeling, but as a field of feeling. And then at any moment, we can narrow down to just one feeling, to one sensation, and pay attention there, or we might broaden out and pay attention to the whole field of vibratory aliveness. When we do that, we realize,
I am present. I am here now. And that message is radiating through, shining through every cell in your body. Your body so present. The mind is so caught in three times, the past, the present, and the future. And it's alternating between those three times. The body is very much in the present, although it holds our history, but it's in the present when we turn to the sensory field. It might be, I can say more about that later. It might be holding our history though. So that can color our present moment perception. The third teaching from body to mind. I put it this way, I think in the description in the song, when Song of Life was asking me for that description, I usually think of this third one as honesty. The body is honest. The mind is not as honest as the body. And what do I mean by the mind is not as honest as the body? I think I said in the description, you are intuitive, which also works too, that your body teaches your mind that you are intuitive. But I like the word honesty too. You know, our mind can lie to us. And it does. It tells us stories, endless stories. It is a storyteller. It's a narrative. It functions on narrative, which in some ways is an incredibly glorious thing about the mind. But it also tends to turn everything into a story, you know. So just to share a little bit from my own life, three weeks ago, my purse, my backpack was stolen from my friend's car in a smash and grab. And a smash and grab means that the thief smashes the window and reaches in and takes whatever's there. And that's what happened to me. And it was my, you know, my passport and my driver's license and cell phone and all my credit cards and cash, everything was in that backpack. And it was all just gone in one moment. And one of the stories, you know, that came up, it's so interesting, right? That, you know, there's no logic to what the mind does, was that, you know, oh, I am cursed. And woe is me. I've had a kind of string of bad luck in a few ways, different ways. And then I was like, oh, you know, something, oh, there must be something. And then I was able to catch myself and go, yeah, that's a story. That's such a story. And so that's what I mean by the mind takes whatever experience we have and it weaves it into a narrative. And we can choose to believe or to not believe these narratives, but the body is always spinning a tale. The mind is always spinning a tale. The body is not telling a tale. The body is very present moment and very intuitive, and it tends to communicate truths that the mind may be overlaying with a story. And the truths are very basic. The body is like a radar. We could say even body, including our amygdala, the parts of the brain that are older than the prefrontal cortex. So we could say that the body is telling the story of whatever right now, it is communicating whatever right now it is feeling or sensing. And sometimes the body is more honest than the mind. So the body, when I really looked at that situation with my snatched purse, what the body was communicating to me is, I'm afraid. Simple message, I'm afraid. And then the mind took that and made a story about, oh, you know, you have a string of bad luck, there's you're cursed, or there's some, you're, you know, the stars are out of alignment, and da, 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 da. But the body was just saying, I'm scared. I feel vulnerable. And when I listened to that message, that very simple momentary message, that felt more truthful to me than the story that the mind was spinning. So we can notice this in many different moments when we're suddenly sensing sort of some change in our energy and we look to ask the body what's true, it may be telling us something different than what the mind is saying. And sometimes, often, the body is more honest. So that's why I say the body is honest or the body is intuitive. The body knows things that the mind will deny and the mind will suppress. But the body will just say communicate a very simple message through what it's feeling. When we turn our attention there, we can pick that message up. And the fourth teaching of the body, wisdom of the body, and then I want to open it up to all of you. I don't want to go too much longer because we're getting close past 3 o'clock, but past the hour. The fourth wisdom of the body, the way the body teaches the mind is, and what it communicates to the mind is, you are non-conceptual. You are non-conceptual. Yes, a part of us is conceptual. We have this overlay of conceptuality. But that's not everything about us. That's not all we are. So when we turn our attention to the body, the mind is thinking, 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 sense-making, meaning-making. But the body is non-conceptual. It has a kind of knowing, but the kind of knowing that the body has is immediate, fresh, direct, in relationship, interdependent, in relationship with its environment. And that knowing is a non-conceptual knowing. So when you feel the breeze on your skin, the mind comes in and interprets that breeze on your skin. But before the mind comes in and interprets that breeze on your skin, there's just a fresh knowing. There's a fresh consciousness in your body. And when you turn attention to that, you notice that's not only in my body, that's also in my consciousness. My consciousness has a corner, or maybe has a whole part to it, that is non-conceptual and holding, it is holding the conceptuality, but it isn't the conceptuality. And I know that might sound a little mysterious. I think especially not to meditators, not so mysterious. Maybe if you all have been, those of you who have been practicing for a while, this will make sense. But if you haven't practiced much and you know, if we've lived a life of the mind, then this can at first sound quite cryptic, that there's a part of our whole experience that is non-conceptual, and that we can learn to see through the eyes of non-conceptuality. We can learn to connect to something deep within us that is a present moment, spacious, luminous, open, knowing awareness that is wakeful. And that is expressing itself through the body mind. And if there's a direction that I'm headed here, it's true I'm prioritizing the wisdom of the body here, but body and mind have never been separate. So I prioritize the wisdom of the body as a corrective to the way we've lived our lives. So prioritizing the mind. And just by inverting that, we can start to balance a little bit and integrate and have a sense of how body and mind have never been separate. So that's a bit of my thoughts today. And I'd like to invite you now to ask some questions, and please come onto the screen if you can. I just think it's so lovely to see your faces. And if you want to do that, you can put it in the chat, I think, that you want to come on screen, and George will help you come on. You can also ask your questions via the questions and answers in the chat. Oh, before we segue to someone coming on the screen too, I wanted to just put in a word about Donna, because I know Sangha Life survives on your generosity, and I wanted to remind you all that that is the case. And I just have been so grateful myself for Sangha Life during the pandemic, and have been coming back every year here to teach, because the community is so powerful and connected. It really kind of converted me. I would say Sangha Life converted me to the possibility that Dharma can be totally transmitted over the medium of the internet. So I have gratitude to them. Okay, I see someone would like to come on. I see Victoria would like to come on, and Sophie. And in the meantime, I know it takes a minute. So we've got a question here. Why does the body, heart, mind fragment so easily during difficult times? Difficult times are always with us, I know, but not everyone is fragmented. Or if they are, they are not bothered by it. Regine, I just want to say that thank you so much for that question. And I think that many of people that may seem like they're not bothered by it, we all are going through something. Everyone goes through something in times like this. So I just want to say that I so relate to your question, and how when times are difficult, there can be this sense of disintegration, a feeling of falling apart that we have at those times. And for myself, I think the answer to that question is that when in difficult times, our mind leaps to make sense of what's happening. And we don't always know how to metabolize our pain. And so our mind leaps to make sense of what is happening, but we don't always have the skills to metabolize the pain. So I think just in a general way, I would say that everyone should have a difficulties practice of some kind. And for myself, my difficulties practice is very connected to the body. And lately, my main technique has been a technique of befriending, because when difficult things are happening, actually difficult things happen inside. Like there's a mirroring effect, right? When the conditions are difficult, we feel anxiety, we feel sometimes rage or confusion. And we need a practice for leaning into. We can't always do something about the conditions, but we can often do something about what's happening in here. So in that way, meditation can be very helpful, the right kinds of practice. So for myself, a practice of befriending in the body, what is arising, has been very helpful. Thank you for the question so much. And great question. So George, feel free to bring Victoria on, or just go ahead when you can. Just go ahead and bring people on. Even if I'm still talking, you can bring them on, and we sit there together until I'm done, is fine. So question from Jeremy. Would you speak to how this type of practice might be supportive to those in helping professions? I work for a contemplatively oriented mental health program. Also, would you recommend using your book as a resource for clinicians, such as going through it together as a group? If so, any suggestions around that? I'm willing to come on screen. Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I think practices of coming into the body and grounding are excellent practices in the contemplative arena of caregiving and of working in contemplative care in a helping profession. That one of the ways that we can mirror for others resilience is by becoming grounded. And becoming grounded is possible through starting to connect more intimately with your state of the body in the present moment, and to learn to how to relax the thinking mind and become more intimate with what is happening in present moment experience. That also gives us space to be with whatever's arising without a lot of reactivity. So, and yeah, I would recommend the book. The Wakeful Body is the book. I can put that in the chat. I don't see, have a link to the where you can get the book. It's by Shambhala Publications. And yeah, I think it's a good one for clinicians. You can go through there. It's in small sections, section by section, and each section has a practice. Almost every section, not every section, but almost every section has a practice. So if you were to go through it with a group, you might, you know, read the part together, each part together, and then do the practice, or read it chapter by chapter, and then take turns reading the practice and leading it for others. Might be a nice way to go through the book. Thank you. All right. Let's see. In my work, this is from Kate. Oh, wow, there's lots of votes for that one too. Okay, let's do this one first. In my work, I try to support people as they find ease in their body. There are many blocks within the body, pain, trauma, cultural messaging, etc., that challenge people to find refuge in the body. What you are suggesting is wonderful when accessed. I appreciate your offering. Yes, yes, a history with trauma and our body history can be needs to be met. I'm not going to even say it's an obstacle. None of it's an obstacle to body practice, but all of it needs to be met in order to engage in a somatic mindfulness practice. So, and that will happen naturally, that as you come down from the thinking space into the body, those parts that are held in the body, the trauma that is held in the body, will be activated sometimes, not all the time, sometimes. And sometimes then when it's activated, we need a way to meet it. And so I recommend a practice of befriending, learning to breathe into and around the feelings as they arise, and to simply make space. And that's the priority. When those things arise, the priority is not the meditation practice. It's not becoming grounded or peaceful, none of that. The priority becomes coming around what it is that you're feeling and making room and befriending and allowing what is there to be held, pause, held in a space of pause and a space eventually of compassion and kindness, learning to hold what's arising with compassion and kindness. And that's a process, right? To learn how to be with what is difficult with that kind of willingness. And in the book, The Wakeful Body, I talk quite a bit about that. There's a whole chapter on that. Yeah. So five votes here. Would you be able to say a little more about how the body holds our history? And I wondered if that history showing itself in the body can be a barrier to us being present. Yes, it certainly can become a barrier. But I don't like the word barrier so much because it does... Words like barrier are a subtle denigration of what the body's holding. The history that the body holds is a history of some woundedness. We all carry some woundedness by virtue of being human and coming into this world as embodied beings. So, and that's not, I think sometimes we think we're unique in that way, but actually trauma is a universal experience. Some people of us have had more than others, but everyone has experienced trauma. And so knowing that can make us feel much less alone. And from my perspective, trauma and the history that we hold in the body, what do I mean by that? Hold in the nervous system. So can you say more about that? That our nervous system holds patterns that are so deep related to what we have experienced. And those patterns are unconscious. And sometimes the memory is not even there anymore of what happened. It may not even be there anymore, but the pattern of reactivity remains in the nervous system. And when a trigger arises, the nervous system will rear up and react with boundaries, and perhaps with anger, perhaps with fear, perhaps with depression, perhaps. I mean, depends on the pattern. And I think the first thing to remember, to acknowledge, is that that feeling that is responding to the trigger is trying to protect you. So barrier, we don't want to other these embodied history, or see it as a barrier, but instead see it as a invitation, that every one of those reactions that we have is an invitation to come alongside the feeling in the subtle body. I'm using the language of my book, come alongside the feeling in the subtle body or in the energy body, and breathe room and space around that feeling, and just allow that to be present. And when we do that, the feeling begins to change. It begins to evolve and eventually to unwind. It doesn't mean the pattern might go away completely, but it unwinds. And I'm speaking as a meditator, right? I'm not speaking as a psychotherapist. I'm speaking as someone who spent many years working with these in a retreat setting in a practice of meditation. Okay. And I know some people are trying to come on screen, so please continue to volunteer if you want to come on screen. Does the body store emotions? Oh, yes. Yeah, that's part of the body's history, right? What we felt, what emotions we have fed, what emotions we have not metabolized, unprocessed, especially emotions lodge in our energy body, and eventually our task will be to process those, to metabolize those, and that starts with befriending, to making space for, making room for those to be present in a way that is kind. Okay. So John says, would you say that the storytelling of the mind is its effort to keep us safe by testing out future scenarios and checking for past errors and lessons from them? Yeah, I do think that's the case. And that if we live in that threat-based context, we get carried away with the possibilities. The body keeps us realistic. That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. I also wanted to pay some homage to the mind here too, that storytelling, that narrative quality is incredible and wonderful, of course, in so many ways. Like, I just have to say, my favorite genre, I love to read. I love narrative, and I love to read memoir. I love how people make sense and make meaning out of their lives. That's my favorite genre, is seeing how people work with what has come up in their life. I find it like the Dharma to read that. It's so powerful. And storytelling can liberate as well as can confine. Yes, I think that we can get carried away with those stories. And sometimes our stories just aren't true. We do so much projecting and believing, trusting that, say, you know, an example, we project on another person a whole story about who they are and what their life has been and why they've made the choices they've made, even when we have no idea. That, and in my perspective, actually, that's the most concerning of our narrative tendencies, the kind that other people and that put them into a box. And we lose the mystery of others. We lose the window into who they are and the window of curiosity when we close down on what we think they are, instead of remaining open and curious as to who they may become and who they really are. We may not really know. So, yeah, thank you for that question, John. Here's another one. Oh, you guys are full of wonderful. I love these. I'm sorry you guys are having trouble coming on screen. I don't know why that is. Hopefully we can figure it out for the next time. Sophie says, I'm wondering how this practice connects to decision-making in the world. Often decisions are based on considering conceptual reality and making sense of that, insert the storyteller mind. So how to make decisions that integrate the honesty of the body? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is really interesting. Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. You know, I think that we're so hyper-vigilant about our lives, and sometimes we have to be. You know, survival is a real challenge on this planet, in this life, in this body. And so I think we have a tendency to lean on our analytical mind and on our logic, on our and on our thinking mind, and we have to sometimes. But there is a space that you can make as a contemplative, as a meditator, for the possibility that you can open up to the wisdom of your body on a particular decision-making topic. And this is something that took me years to start to trust, actually. But as I began to trust it more, it has opened up such vistas for me around making decisions. So to give you an example, you know, taking the thing you're trying to make a decision about and coming down from your thinking mind into your feeling body, grounding through the feet, and noticing how one outcome, how your body responds to one outcome of that decision. Let's make it, say it's a simple decision. Let's say there's two options. How does my body respond to option A? And visualize yourself in the end result of option A, and then option B. How does your body feel in that option? And it's really interesting. The messages you can get can be different from what your mind is saying. Your mind can be, or they might be compatible. It might be, oh yeah, that settles it. Mind and body are both for that. But sometimes mind is for this and body is for this. And then it kind of gives you more to reflect on. Okay, why is that? And you know, what is it that my body is resisting about what my mind is telling me I ought to do? It, and it opens up all these levels of inquiry. So it can be really interesting to make a decision based on your mind's wisdom and then asking, okay, what's my body's take on this? All right. What else do we have here? Okay, someone's asking about, and I will mention this group, Sally, retreat events that are coming up. Let me turn to that in a few minutes. I'll do that right at the very end. Okay. Feeling and unwinding. So Diana asks, what do you mean by feeling, by a feeling unwinding? I'm glad you asked that. Yeah. In some ways, the whole practice of awakening is a practice of unwinding. And what we're doing in meditation is not so much a doing as an undoing. That we're unlearning the habits of efforting and contriving, planning, and in the unlearning of that, there's a lot of release of this energy of karma. Karma being our patterns, our habitual patterns, and that when we start to relax, those patterns unwind themselves. And to trust that something will unwind itself takes a lot of practice. I think in meditation practice, we learn that we don't have to free things. I don't have to free my anger. I don't have to free my fear. I need to make space so that my anger can free itself, will free itself, and so that my fear will free itself. So we are becoming adept at creating the conducive conditions for the self-liberation of the bondage that is underlying our suffering. And that's different from untying the bonds. So a lot can be learned by seeing, experimenting with seeing your practice as an undoing, as an a training in the deepest relaxation possible, and that when we relax, these feelings or difficult patterns unwind themselves. So practice becomes the setting up of the context for that. And now we're getting closer to the end, so I can share with you a bit about where to learn more, or you're welcome to join me on retreats if you like. So two things I can mention just in passing here are, one, I'm having a conversation with Martin Aylward. This is just not a course, but just a conversation in December through the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. And Martin, of course, is the founder of Song Alive, and I'm really excited to be talking to him. I'm sort of interviewing him about his book, and he's interviewing me about mine. So we're doing like a joint sort of interactive conversational interview with each other. And that's at Barry Center for Buddhist Studies online. So feel free to join us for that. You can find that on the website for Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, or the website, my website, which is at naturaldharma.org. And I'll put that down here too. The other thing I can mention, I put my website down there, is that I'm teaching a 6-month course starting next year in February. And it's just easy, very doable for anybody in working or not, in a very easy to do course that goes for 6 months. We meet once a week, and we'll also have a small cohort. And that's on the wakeful body. It's on what I'm just taught here, but unfolding that as a 6-month training for becoming more embodied in your practice of meditation. And it includes some modules of yoga, which are optional. So there will be access to some yoga practice and training too. And third thing I can mention is a week-long retreat in January of next year that we are offering online. And that's an intensive retreat, I think starting on the 2nd or the 3rd of January. You can find that on naturaldharma.org. And you can find the 6-month course there too. If it's not up, it will be up within days. It should be up really soon if it's not already there. Okay. And, Caverly is coming next week too. That's great. Thank you so much. And thank you all for coming. It's been such a pleasure to see you, and I can see your faces actually under the people link here.
Even though your cameras aren't turned on, I can see many of your faces and names and where you're from. And I'm just so grateful to be with you here this morning. Thank you so much for coming. Hope to see you again soon.